We're delighted to have Father James Keenan with us today. He is the Founders Professor of Theology here at Boston College. As many of you know, his research interests include fundamental moral theology, history of theological ethics, Thomas Aquinas, virtue ethics, HIV/AIDS, genetics, and on and on. He served as a consultant to the National Conference of Catholic Bishops for the revision of the ethical guidelines for Catholic healthcare institutions and as an advisor to Global AIDS Interfaith Alliance. He's the author of a number of books, four of which will be published in 2010, three already. I'll just mention one or two. Most importantly, recently, History of Catholic Moral Theology, a magisterial book that I encourage everyone to look at. And he's also the editor of Catholic Ethicists on HIV/AIDS Prevention, and also notably with Daniel Harrington, Jesus and Virtue Ethics, Building Bridges Between New Testament Studies and Moral Theology. He has a large group that I hope you'll check out. His doctorate degree is from the Gregorian University in Rome. And today he'll be speaking about what is HIV/AIDS led us to understand about global ethical challenges. Thank you, Jim, for being here.
Okay, thank you. Let me just say a few things of what I do and why I do it and how it's related to what I think are the challenges that are on the horizon or that we're actually finally recognizing. In as much as they've been there for centuries. I have to say that I'm very influenced by an event last night in which Andrea Bocchini spoke on the natural law and talked about issues of pluralism and globalization and relationality and universality. And then Lisa Cahill responded by talking about embodiment and equality to points, many points, but those are two that I certainly have now entered into my framework of thinking. So it's very nice to be at a university where such colleagues are engaging us broadly. So I started teaching in 1987, and when I started teaching, it was at Fordham. And I had just finished 5 years in Rome, and I decided that I wanted to teach a course that it would be in ethics and that may be engaging, and I called it abortion. And I taught it for 17 weeks, three classes a week. I assigned two articles per class and gave a quiz to each one to make sure that the students read what was required. But my premise was a simple one, that everybody talks about abortion, but nobody reads much about it. I mean, some people do, but for the most part, we're illiterate on something that we take very seriously. And so I thought that perhaps the foundation to good ethics is information, whether it's ethical guidelines, ethical teachings, whether it's experiential reporting, whether there's some information, some statistics, some biological questions. What is the relationship as to why women pursue abortions, why they are forced into them, whatever it is. How much do we know about it? And I did that for 4 years, and it was terrific. And then I ended up teaching at Weston, where I had graduate students. So I didn't do anything like that until I came back into undergraduate work here 7 years ago. And then I decided, well, let's do a course on HIV/AIDS and ethics. And I had done this with graduate students over at Weston, but it was more to help, well, how should you develop yourself ministerially for work in a world of HIV/AIDS? But here I wanted to do it to try to get students more familiar with, well, what are the challenges of HIV/AIDS? And rather than giving them facts, like numbers, but I'll give you some right now, even though it was only recognized in 1981, by 1999 it had become the fourth greatest cause of death in the world, accounting for almost 5% of all deaths worldwide, and 3 million deaths per year. So it's really extraordinary that in 20 years it could have this dramatic impact. In sub-Saharan Africa, AIDS is the leading cause of death, accounting for more than one-fifth of all deaths in sub-Saharan Africa. Today there are 42 million people living with HIV/AIDS, and there are 25 million who have died. So 67 million have been infected by this virus. there are nearly 14,000 new infections every day. And the vast majority occur in developing countries through heterosexual transmission by persons who are largely unaware of their HIV status. And that's your fair. Half of new infections occur in women, and 2,000 a day occur in persons younger than 15 years of age. So that just gives you some sense of the proportionality of this. I came up with another factoid that I basically created, but it seems to be true. I think we were all struck in 2004 by the Indian Ocean tsunami. 300,000 people just suddenly wiped out. I mean, it was an experience that happened that I think was really extraordinary. And the response to the tsunami was really rather impressive as how people wanted to get involved. But you know, that 300,000, that's every 37 days, there are 300,000 people who die of HIV. It is a tsunami every 37 days. Could you imagine if we really had a tsunami every 37 days, how we would respond to that? So I use that as an indicator to say that I think that to some extent the challenge is not only of medicine, but it's also making accessible treatment and prevention strategies that would be more effective. I think that the response to the tsunami is different from the response to AIDS, and I think that there's a lot of reasons for that, but I think highlighting the response is somewhat helpful. What I try to do in this course is that I try to get students to read narratives of persons who are become HIV infected. And this is a book that actually Lisa helped put together, Catholic Ethicists on HIV AIDS Prevention. But we put together about 37 cases. We asked major moralists around the world to name what are an obstacle to cases, to prevention strategies in your part of the world. And they began to give us, you know, these fairly complex cases. It could be, for instance, in Colombia, the case from Colombia was of a physician who became himself HIV infected, and he was a teaching member of the medical school faculty in Bogota. And he was HIV infected, and the staff needed to know whether he got it from having sex with men. They needed to know. They violated all confidentiality just to get through. And so one other thing that the writer from Colombia wanted to highlight is that the homophobia is so strong in Latin America, and yet, the transmission of HIV in Latin America is predominantly by men having sex with men. And so this kind of highlighted that there. However, in Costa Rica, we had a case of a woman who learns that her husband's illness is HIV. And she really only gets that confirmed when she finds out that one of her children is HIV, and then she discovers that she's HIV. And here in the experience in Costa Rica is how she, actually the case is a fascinating one because the doctor has been treats the husband and wife has known for 5 or 6 years that the husband was HIV infected and never communicated anything to the wife, never communicated anything about the possibility of the transmission of the virus to the children or to the wife, obviously. And when he dies, that's when she finds out that it was HIV. And so it's a question of the paternalism of many medical institutions and how they really do protect men's access to information, but not women's access to information, and what this means when a family becomes infected. But we had cases from all over. Probably my favorite case is from Turkana tribe in East Africa, in which this was looking at probably one of the largest nomadic tribes, and we had one ethicist from Kenya write this story up. But in this part of the world, the sub-Saharan experience is really not sub-Saharan, it's Saharan. The Saharan desert has just gone further and further. And if you were a member of the Kana tribe, in order to get married, there would be an exchange of goats, a large number of goats. And those goats were herded in, you know, the grasslands that no longer exist. And because of that, there are no longer goats. And so the dowry that was fixed by goats has now eradicated, and men are not getting goats, and therefore they're not getting wives, and therefore they're actually not getting married. And they have a variety of different sexual relationships, and women, because they're not getting married, are going into these paid sexual relationships. And there's been an enormous breakdown in an ancient tribal culture that's been nomadic, that really depended on certain practices that internally have not yet dealt with HIV and its reality, but it's been affected by economics. So the whole course is, one third of the course is to give an exposure to who are people who most at risk to HIV and why. What does gender inequity have to do with it? Why is it that people who are poorer are more at risk? Why is it that people who are forced into migration are more at risk? What are the real constitutive questions about the riskiness of HIV transmission? So I try to do that. And then the remaining two parts of the course, one is on prevention strategies and what constitutes prevention strategies in people's minds. And then the second is what we're in right now, and that is to get an appreciation of what is access. In the 1980s and 1990s, whenever the International Conference on AIDS met, the approach toward HIV infections in the developing world was hospice. I mean, until 1996, if there was any discussion on how to treat people who are HIV infected, it was to be prepared for full-blown AIDS and to provide hospice. I mean, I remember one discussion that went on at length that they would provide the coffins, you know, that richer industrialized nations would provide coffins. There was certainly no anticipation that treatment, antiretroviral treatments, would be incorporated in this. So since about 1996, this is when they're preparing for conferencing in Bangkok and then later on in South Africa, they began to be a realization that even though there was this enormous gap between the HIV infection in the developing world and the HIV infection in the industrialized world, that there needed to be some way of bridging that gap. In the developing world, HIV is a terminal disease. In the industrialized world, it's now considered a chronic illness. That's what treatment does. So that that when we say that there are all these new HIV infections, we also want to know where, because where they are means whether or not it's a terminal disease or a chronic infection. But it gives us an idea immediately as to where that where we need to go and how we need to address things. And Wentz might commented that Lisa's point on equality is something I've been bringing up in terms of all the inequities. But let me just say one more thing and then break off. And that is that in doing this work, it's so different from when I worked on abortion, you know, in the late 80s and trying to teach on that. Ethics, bioethics, has for the most part, and this is a generalization and therefore it's problematic, for the most part dealt with issues about my relationship or a person's relationship with their physician or some sort of clinician. So beginning of life issues, end of life issues, this is the stock of a lot of bioethics courses until the mid or late 90s. people would talk about abortion, in vitro fertilization, end-of-life issues, assisted suicide, a variety of different things. Of course, these are all conditioned on the premise that you have a doctor with whom you're speaking and you have access to that doctor, and in our country we've just had this enormous debate about access to healthcare. But in the world with, you know, more than 70% of people do not have access to healthcare, this is not the way to teach bioethics. The issue of bioethics has to be prior to the question of whether I have a choice about the a question of pregnancy or about dying or any of these matters. It has to be in a whole new context. And many of us in ethics find that our interlocutor are still physicians and nurses and their experiences, as well as patients and their experiences. But there's been a new interlocutor, and that's the public health official, that we're now looking at medical ethical questions under the rubric not only of the principle of autonomy or of human dignity or of what personal obligations or responsibilities I may have, we're also looking at how the principle of justice, how issues like human rights actually affect healthcare. Why is it that the poor are sicker, or if you become sick, you will become poorer? Why is it that, and this is a question that Jeffrey Sachs and Paul Farmer have raised repeatedly, why is it that there's a deep corollary between economics and social stability on the one hand and health on the other? And is there not an obligation to address that? Now, public health officials are doing that. Public health officials were not doing it until people like Jonathan Mann and others began to try to figure out how can we discuss that, and then they began proposing the language of human rights. Similarly, for those of us working in ethics, there's been a sea change in that we've been listening more attentively to, I think, the prognostications not only of a doctor's experience with her or his patients, but now we're looking at public health officials about their strategies. And so the principle of autonomy has now decreased, if you will, in terms of its overarching a way of providing a hermeneutics for discovering what's the ethics of this matter or that, and justice has taken its place. So this question of incorporating justice into bioethics in part happened, I think, it would naturally have happened, I think, in terms of the developments in theology and the rest. But HIV has shown us, without a doubt, that if we don't deal with justice, if we don't deal with economic and social structures, we're never going to be able to deal with this. Last factoid, for every two persons who receive treatment, every two new persons who begin to receive treatment, there are five new infections. So the rate that we're going in right now, where we're providing more and more treatment availability, is being outdistanced by all the problems in trying to inhibit the prevention, transmission of the virus. So that's enough to just serve as perhaps a catalyst for a discussion.